of Christmases Long, Long Ago is my new book, arriving for the 2025 Christmas season. Find out what Christmas was like centuries ago. Sneak preview, it was weird, and spooky, and rowdy, kind of gross sometimes. Find it wherever books are sold, in hardcover from Lions Press, and audiobook from Recorded Books. It's Christmas as you've never seen it before, and it makes a great gift. Happy Thanksgiving, everyone, and welcome to Season 10 of Christmas Past. Season 10. Can you believe it? Sometimes I can't. I think back to when I decided to create Christmas Past. Oh, I was so much younger then. I had no idea if this would be a one-off, an experiment. I had no idea if anyone would listen, if I could keep the same motivation and dedication season after season. A lot of podcasts do come and go, but we're still here. Together, 10 seasons in, and more inspired than ever to keep things going, to keep this family of ours growing, and to keep the Christmas spirit fresh and alive through storytelling and curiosity and connection. Over 10 seasons, Christmas Past has brought incredible and unexpected moments. Book deals, celebrity interviews, live shows, television and radio appearances, public speaking opportunities. But through it all, the one constant, the beating heart, has been you, and our shared fascination with the most wonderful time of the year, and the trust you've placed in Christmas Past to keep coming back season after season. And so, here we are, ready to kick off, officially, another Christmas season together. Thank you for being here. I hope you had a wonderful Thanksgiving, and I hope the coming season is filled with comfort and joy. I'll be there with you all along. Now, a little programming note. Starting next week, you can look forward to new episodes at least 3 times a week on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. There will be additional bonus episodes here and there. And we'll finish out the season 4 weeks from today on Christmas Day with our annual Christmas in Review episode. And be on the lookout for a special mini episode in the coming days, featuring some announcements about the rest of the season, as well as highlights from my annual visit to the Great Dickens Christmas Fair in San Francisco. But today, I wanted to bring you another ghost story. A little something to put a bit of extra chill into a late autumn evening. Our Victorian forebears loved to call the spirits of the departed during the Christmas season. It's a tradition that has largely disappeared, like a ghost. But my friends at Biblioasis Publishing are helping to change that. Every year, they publish a series of 3 classic Victorian ghost stories for Christmas, beautifully designed and illustrated by the acclaimed artist known only as Seth. Ghost stories published for Christmas during Victorian times didn't necessarily involve Christmas. In fact, most of them didn't. But some did, like today's story. In preparation for the upcoming Christmas celebrations, the servants of a wealthy Mr. Braxton unwittingly cut a tree from the sacred grounds of Lucky's Grove. As the guests arrive, injuries, illness, and mysterious occurrences soon plague Abingdale Hall, with the worst to come on Christmas Day. It's H. Russell Wakefield's short story, Lucky's Grove. I'll be back at the end to wrap up and say goodbye, but for now, cozy up, make sure the lights are on, and listen on, if you dare. Mr. Braxton strolled with his land agent Curtis into the great barn. "There you are," said Curtis in a satisfied tone. "The finest little fir I ever saw, and the kiddies will never set eyes on a lovelier Christmas tree." Mr. Braxton examined it. It stood 20 feet from huge green pot to crisp straight peak, and was exquisitely sturdy, fresh, and symmetrical. "Yes, it's a beauty," he agreed. "Where did you find it?" "In that odd little spinney they call Lucky's Grove in the long meadow near the river boundary." "Oh," remarked Mr. Braxton uncertainly. To himself, he was saying vaguely, "He shouldn't have got it from there. Of course, he wouldn't realize it, but he shouldn't have got it from there." "Of course, we'll replant it," said Curtis, noticing his employer's diminished enthusiasm. "It's a curious thing, but it isn't a young tree. It's apparently full grown. Must be a dwarf variety, but I don't know as much about trees as I should like." Mr. Braxton was surprised to find that there was one branch of country lore on which Curtis was not an expert. For he was about the best-known man at his job in the British Isles. Pigs, bees, chickens, cattle, crops, running a chute, he had mastered them one and all. He paid him $2,000 a year with house and car. He was worth triple. "I expect it's all right," said Mr. Braxton. "It's just that Lucky's Grove is, well, sacred is perhaps too strong a word. Maybe I should have told you, but I expect it's all right." "That accounts for it then," laughed Curtis. "I thought there seemed some reluctance on the part of the men while we were yanking it up and getting it on the lorry. They handled it a bit gingerly. On the part of the older men, I mean. The youngsters didn't worry." "Yes, there would be," said Mr. Braxton. "But never mind, it'll be back in a few days, and it's a superb little tree. I'll bring Mrs. Braxton along to see it after lunch." And he strolled back to Abingdale Hall. 55 years ago, Mr. Braxton's father had been a laborer on this very estate, and in that year, young Percy, aged 8, had got an errand boy's job in Oxford. 20 years later, he'd owned one small shop. 25 years after that, 50 big shops. Now, though he had finally retired, he owned 280 vast shops and was a millionaire whichever way you added it up. How had this happened? No one can quite answer such questions. Certainly he'd worked like a brigade of Trojans, but midnight oil has to burn in Aladdin's lamp before it can transform ninepence into 1,000,000 pounds. It was just that he asked no quarter from the unforgiving minute, but squeezed from it the fruit of others' many hours. Those like Mr. Braxton seem to have their own time scale. They just say the word and up springs a fine castle of commerce, but the knowledge of that word cannot be imparted. It's as mysterious as the Logos. But all through his great labors, he had been moved by one fixed resolve, to avenge his father, that fettered spirit, for he had been an able, intelligent man who had no earthly chance of revealing the fact to the world. Although the categorical determination had blazed in his son's brain, "I will own Abingdale Hall, and where my father sweated, I will rule and be lord." And of course, it had happened. Fate accepts the dictates of such men as Mr. Braxton, shrugs its shoulders, and leaves its revenge to death. The hall had come on the market just as he was about to retire, and with an odd delight, an obscure sense of homecoming, the native returned, and his riding boots, shooting boots, golf shoes, and all the other many glittering guineas worth stamped in and obliterated the prints of his father's hobnails. That was the picture he often revisualized, the way it amused him to put it to himself as he roamed his broad acres and surveyed the many great glowing triumphs of his model husbandry. Some credit was due to buxom, blithe, and debonair Mrs. Braxton, kindly competent and innately adaptable. She was awaiting him in the morning room, and they went in solitary state to luncheon. But it was the last peaceful lunch they would have for a spell. The families were pouring in on the morrow. As a footman was helping them to sole Meunier, Mr. Braxton said, "Curtis has found a very fine Christmas tree. It's in the barn. You must come to look at it after lunch." "That is good," replied his wife. "Where did he get it from?" Mr. Braxton hesitated for a moment. "From Lucky's Grove." Mrs. Braxton looked up sharply. "From the Grove?" she said, surprised. "Yes, of course. He didn't realize. Anyway, it'll be all right. It's all rather ridiculous, and it'll be replanted before the new year." "Oh, yes," agreed Mrs. Braxton. "After all, it's only just a clump of trees." "Quite. And it's just the right height for the ballroom. It'll be taken in there tomorrow morning, and the electricians will work on it in the afternoon." "I heard from Lady Pouncer just now," said Mrs. Braxton. "She's bringing 6 over, and that'll make 74, only 2 refusals. The presents are arriving this afternoon." They discussed the pay discursively over the cutlets of Panche Melba, and soon after lunch walked across to the barn. Mrs. Braxton waved to Curtis, who was examining a new tractor in the garage 50 yards away, and he came over. Mrs. Braxton looked over the tree and was graciously delighted with it, but remarked that the pot could have done with another coat of paint. She pointed to several streaks, rust-colored, running through the green. "Of course, it won't show when it's wrapped, but they didn't do a very good job." Curtis leaned in. "They certainly didn't," he said irritably. "I'll see to it. I think it's filled over from the soil. That copse is in a curious patch of red sand. There are some Frilford, too. When we pulled it up, I noticed the roots were stained a dark crimson." He put his hand down and scraped at the stains with his thumb. He seemed a shade puzzled. "It shall have another coat at once," he said. "What do you think of Lamson and Collett's scheme for the barn?" quite good, replied Mrs. Braxton, but the sketches for the chairs are too fancy. I agree, said Curtis, who usually did so in the case of unessentials, reserving his tactful vetoes for the others. The great barn was by far the most aesthetically satisfying, as it was the oldest feature of the hall buildings. It was vast, exquisitely proportioned, and mellow. That could hardly be said for the house itself, which the fourth Baron of Abingdale had rebuilt on the cinders of its predecessor in 1752. This nobleman had traveled abroad extensively and returned with the most enthusiastic, grandiose, and indigestible ideas of architecture. The result was a gargantuan piece of rococo jocoso, which only an entirely humorless pedant could condemn. It contained 48 bedrooms and 8 reception rooms, so Mrs. Braxton had made at the last recount. But Mr. Braxton had not repeated with the interior the errors of the fourth Baron. He briefed the greatest expert in Europe with the result that the interior was quite tasteful and sublimely comfortable. "Ugh!" he exclaimed as they stepped out into the air. "It is getting nippy." "Yes," said Curtis, "there's a nor'easter blowing up. Maybe snow for Christmas." On getting back to the house, Mrs. Braxton went into a huddle with the butler and the housekeeper, and Mr. Braxton retired to a study for a doze. But instead, his mind settled on Lucky's Grove. When he'd first seen it again after buying the estate, it seemed as if 50 years had rolled away, and he realized that Abingdale was far more summed up to him in that little copse than the gigantic barracks 2 miles away. At once he felt home again. Yet, just as it had been when he was a small boy, the emotion the grove had aroused in him had been sharply tinged with awe. And so had it been now, half a century later. He still had a sneaking dread of it. How precisely could he see it, glowing darkly in the womb of the fire before him, standing starkly there in the center of the big, fallow field, a perfect circle? And first, a ring of holm oaks, and facing east, a breach therein to the firs, and past them on the west, a gap to the yews. It had always required a tug at his courage, not always forthcoming, to pass through them and face the mighty Scotch fir, rearing up its great bole from the grass mound. And when he stood before it, he'd always known an odd longing to fling himself down and, well, worship, it was the only word, the towering tree. His father had told him his forebears had done that very thing, but always when alone and at certain seasons of the year, and that no bird or beast was ever seen there. A lot of traditional nonsense, no doubt, but he himself had absorbed the spirit of the place and knew it would always be so. One afternoon in late November, a few weeks after they had moved in, he'd gone off alone in the drowsing, misty dark, and when he'd reached the holm oak bastion and seen the great tree surrounded by its sentinels, he'd known again that quick turmoil of confused emotions. As he'd walked slowly toward it, it seemed to quicken and be aware of his coming. And as he passed the shallow, grassy fosse and entered the oak ring, he felt that there was something he ought to say, some greeting, some password, or prayer. It was the most aloof, silent little place under the sun, and oh so old. He tiptoed past the firs and faced the barrier of yews. He'd stood there for a long, musing minute, tingling with the sensation that he was being watched and regarded. At length he stepped forward and stood before the God. That mighty word came abruptly and unforeseen, and he felt a wild desire to fling himself down on the mound and do obeisance. And then he'd hurried home. As he recalled all those most vividly and minutely, he was seized with a sudden gust of uncontrollable anger at the thought of the desecration of the grove. He knew now that if he had the slightest idea of Curtis's purpose, he would have resisted and opposed it. But it was too late now. He realized he'd worked himself up rather absurdly. What could it matter? He was still a superstitious bumpkin at heart. Anyway, it was no fault of Curtis. It was the finest Christmas tree anyone could hope for, and the whole thing was too nonsensical for words. The general tone of these sedantic conclusions did not quite accurately represent his thoughts, a very rare failing for Mr. Braxton. About dinner time, a blizzard was setting furiously in and the snow was flying. "Chains on the cars tomorrow," Mrs. Braxton told the head chauffeur. "Boar's Head will be a beggar," thought that person. Mr. and Mrs. Braxton dined early, casually examined the presents, and went to bed. Mr. Braxton was asleep at once, as usual, but he was awakened by the beating of a blind which was slapping its moorings. Reluctantly, he got out of bed and went to fix it. As he was doing so, he became conscious of the frenzied, hysterical barking of a dog. The sound, muffled by the gale, came, he judged, from the barn. He believed the underkeeper kept the whippet there. Scared by the storm, he supposed, and returned to bed. The morning was brilliantly fine and cold, but the snowfall had been heavy. "I heard a dog howling in the night, Perkins," Mr. Braxton said to the butler at breakfast. "Drake's, I imagined. What's the matter with it?"
"I will ascertain, sir," replied Perkins.
It was Drake's dog, he announced a little later. Apparently something alarmed the animal, for when Drake went to let it out in the morning, it appeared to be extremely frightened. When the barn door was opened, it took to its heels and, although Drake pursued it, it jumped into the river, and Drake fears it was drowned.
Said Mr. Braxton, "must have been the storm. Whippets are nervous dogs."
"So I understand, sir." "Drake was so fond of it," said Mrs. Braxton, "though it always looked so naked and shivering to me."
"Yes, madam," agreed Perkins. "It had that appearance."
Soon after, Mr. Braxton sauntered out into the blinding glitter. Curtis came over from the garage. He was heavily muffled up. "They've got the chains on all the cars," he said. "Very seasonable and all that, but the farmers have another word for it." His voice was thick and hoarse.
"Yes," said Mr. Braxton. "You're not looking very fit."
"Not feeling it. Had to get up in the night. Thought I heard someone trying to break into the house. Thought I saw him, too."
"Indeed," said Mr. Braxton. "Did you see what he was like?"
"No," replied Curtis uncertainly. "It was snowing like the devil. Anyway, I got properly chilled to the marrow skipping around in my nightie."
"You'd better get to bed," said Mr. Braxton solicitously. He had affection and a great respect for Curtis.
"I'll stick it out today and see how I feel tomorrow. We're going to get the tree across in a few minutes. Can I borrow the two footmen? I want another couple of pullers and haulers."
Mr. Braxton consented and went off on his favorite little stroll across the sparkling meadows into the river and the pool where the big trout set their cunning noses to the stream. Half an hour later, Curtis had mobilized his scratch team of sleeve-rolled assistants and, with Perkins steering and himself braking, they got to grips with the tree and bore it like a camouflaged battering ram toward the ballroom, which occupied the left center of the frenetic frontage of the ground floor. There was a good deal of bumping and boring and genial blasphemy before the tree was maneuvered into the middle of the room and levered by rope and muscle into position. As it came up, its pinnacle just cleared the ceiling. Sam, a cowman, whose ginger mob had been buried in the foliage for some time, exclaimed tartly as he slapped the trunk, "There you are, you old sod. Thanks for the scratches on me mug, you old..." The next minute he was lying on his back, a livid wheal across his right cheek. This caused general merriment, and even Perkins permitted himself a spectral smile. There was more astonishment than pain on the face of Sam. He stared at the tree in a humble way for a moment, like a chastised and guilty dog, and then slunk away from the room. The merriment of the others died away.
"More spring in these branches than you'd think," said Curtis to Perkins.
"No doubt, sir, that it is due to the abrupt release of the tension," replied Perkins scientifically. The families met at Paddington and traveled down together, so at 5 o'clock, three carloads drew up to the hall. There were Jack and Mary with Patty, aged 8, Walter and Pamela with Jane and Peter, 7 and 5, respectively, and George and Gloria with Gregory and Phyllis, 10 and 8. Jack and Walter were sons of the house. They were much of a muchness, burly, handsome, and as dominating as their sire. A fine pair of commercial kings, entirely capable rulers, but just lacking that something which founds dynasties. Their wives conformed equally to the social type to which they belonged, good lookers, smart dressers, excellent wives and mothers, but rather coolly colorless spiritually. Their offspring were charming children, flawless products of the English matrix, though Patty showed signs of some obstreperous originality. George was the Honorable George. Calvin, Roderick, etc., Pannibals, and Gloria was Mr. and Mrs. Braxton's only daughter. George had inherited 500,000 and had started off at 24 to be something big in the city. In a sense, he achieved his ambition, for 2 years later he was generally reckoned the biggest something in the city, from which he then withdrew, desperately clutching his last 100,000 and vowing lachrymous repentance. He had kept his word and his wad, hunted and shot 6 days a week in the winter, and spent most of the summer wrestling with the 24 devils in his golf bag. According to current jargon, he was the complete extrovert. But what a relief are such in spite of the pitying shrugs of those who forever are peering into the septic recesses of their souls. Gloria had inherited some of her father's force. She was rather overwhelmingly primed with energy and pep for her opportunities of releasing it. So she was always rather pent up and explosive, though maternity had kept the pressure down. She was dispassionately fond of George, who had presented her with a nice little title and aristocratic background and 2 charming children. Phyllis gave promise of such extreme beauty that, beyond being the cynosure of every press camera's eye and making a resounding match, no more was to be expected of her. Gregory, however, on the strength of some aristocratic precocity and a violent temper, was always somewhat prematurely marked down as a genius to be. Such were the families. During the afternoon, 4 engineers arrived from one of the Braxton factories to fix up the lighting on the tree. The fairy lamps for this had been specially designed and executed for the occasion. Disney figures had been grafted upon them and made to revolve by an ingenious mechanism. The effect had been to give the tree, when illuminated, an aspect of whirling life meant to be very cheerful and pleasing. Mr. Braxton happened to see these electricians departing in their lorry and noticed one of them had a bandaged arm and a rather white face. He asked Perkins what had happened. "A slight accident, sir. A bulb burst and burnt him in some manner. But the injury is, as I understand, not of a very serious nature."
"He looked a bit white."
"Apparently, sir, he got a fright, a shock of some kind, when the bulb exploded." After dinner, the grown-ups went to the ballroom. Mr. Braxton switched on the mechanism and great enthusiasm was shown. "Won't the kiddies love it," said George, grinning at the kaleidoscope. "Look at the big bad wolf. He looks so darned realistic. I'm not sure I'd give him a U certificate."
"It's almost frightening," said Pamela. "They look incredibly real. Daddy, you really are rather bright, darling."
It was arranged that the work of decoration would be tackled on the morrow and finished on Christmas Eve. "All the presents have arrived," said Mrs. Braxton, "and are being unpacked. But I'll explain about them tomorrow." Presently, Gloria puffed and remarked, "Papa, aren't you keeping the house rather too hot?"
"I noticed the same thing," said Mrs. Braxton.
Mr. Braxton walked over to the thermometer on the wall.
"You're right," he remarked, 70.
He rang the bell.
"Perkins," he asked, "who's on the furnace?"
"Churchill, sir."
"Well, he's overdoing it. It's 70. Tell him to get it back to 57.
Perkins departed and returned shortly after. "Churchill informs me that he has damped down and cannot account for the increased warmth, sir."
"Tell him to get it back to 57 at once," rapped Mr. Braxton.
"Very good, sir."
"Open a window," said Mrs. Braxton.
"It is snowing again, madam."
"Never mind."
"My God!" exclaimed Mary when she and Jack went up to bed. "That furnace is certainly stepping on it. Open all the windows." A wild flurry of snow beat against the curtains. Mr. Braxton did what he very seldom did, woke up in the early hours. He awoke sweating from a furtive and demoralizing dream. It had seemed to him that he had been crouching down in the foss around Lucky's Grove and peering beneath the holm oaks, and that there had been activity of a sort vaguely to be discerned therein, some quick, shadowy business. He knew a very tight terror at the thought of being detected at this spying, but he could not wrench himself away. That was all, and he awoke still trembling and troubled. No wonder he'd had such a nightmare. The room seemed like a stokehold. He went to the windows and flung another open, and as he did so, he glanced out. His room looked over the rock garden and down the path to the maze. Something moving just outside it caught his eye. He thought he knew what it was, that big old Alsatian which had been sheep-worrying in the neighborhood. What an enormous brute! Or was it just because it was outlined against the snow? It vanished suddenly, apparently into the maze. He'd organize a hunt for it after Christmas. If the snow lay, it should be easy to track.
The first thing he did after breakfast was send for Churchill, severely reprimand him, and threaten him with dismissal from his ship. That person was almost tearfully insistent that he had obeyed orders and kept his jets low. "I can't make it out, sir. It's got no right to be as hot as what it is." "That's nonsense," said Mr. Braxton. "The system has been perfected and cannot take charge as you suggest. See to it. You don't want me to get an engineer down, do you?"
"No, sir."
"That's enough. Get it to 57 and keep it there." Shortly after, Mrs. Curtis rang up to say that her husband was quite ill with a temperature and that the doctor was coming. Mr. Braxton asked her to ring him after he'd been. During the morning, the children played in the snow. After a pitched battle in which the girls lost their tempers, Gregory organized the erection of a snowman. He designed, the others fetched the material. He knew he had a reputation for brilliance to maintain and produce something Epsteinish, huge and squat. The other children regarded it with little enthusiasm, but being Gregory, they supposed it must be admired. When it was finished, Gregory wandered off by himself while the others went in to dry. He came in a little late for lunch, during which he was silent and preoccupied. Afterwards, the grown-ups sallied forth. "Let's see your snowman, Greg," said Gloria, in a mother-of-genius tone. "It isn't all his. We helped," said Phyllis, voicing a point of view which was to have many echoes in the coming years. "Why, he's changed it," exclaimed a chorus 2 minutes later. "What an ugly thing," exclaimed Mary, rather pleased at being able to say so with conviction. Gregory had certainly given his imagination its head, for now the squat, inert trunk was topped by a big wolf's head, with open jaw and ears snarlingly laid back, surprisingly well modeled. Trailing behind it was a coiled serpentine tail. "Whatever gave you the idea for that?" asked Jack. Usually Gregory was facile and eloquent in explaining his inspiration, but this time he refused to be drawn, bit his lip, and turned away. There was a moment's silence when Gloria said with convincing emphasis, "I think it's wonderful, Greg." Then they strolled off to examine the pigs and the poultry and the Suffolk punches. The telephone rang in Mr. Braxton's study. It was Mrs. Curtis. The patient was no better, and Dr. Knowles had seemed rather worried and so on. So Mr. Braxton rang up the doctor. "I haven't diagnosed his trouble yet," he said, "and I'm going to watch him carefully and take a blood test if he's not better tomorrow. He has a temperature of 102, but no other superficial symptoms, which is rather peculiar. By the way, one of your cowmen, Sam Colley, got a nasty wound on his face yesterday and shows signs of blood poisoning. I'm considering sending him to the hospital. Some of the other men have been in to see me. Quite a little outbreak of illness since Tuesday. However, I hope we'll have a clean bill again soon. I'll keep you informed about Curtis." Mr. Braxton was one of those incredible people who never have a day's illness till their first and last. Consequently, his conception of disease was unimaginative and mechanical. If one of his more essential human machines was running unsatisfactorily, there was a machine mender called a doctor whose business it was to ensure that all the plug leads were attached firmly and that the manifold drain pipe was not blocked. But he found himself beginning to worry about Curtis. And this little epidemic amongst his henchmen affected him disagreeably. There was something disturbing to his spirit about it. But just what and why, he couldn't analyze and decide. After dinner, with the children out of the way, the business of decorating the tree was begun. The general scheme had been sketched out and colored by one of the Braxton display experts, and the company consulted this as they worked, which they did rather silently. Possibly Mr. Braxton's palpable anxiety somewhat affected them. Pamela stayed behind after the others had left the ballroom to put some finishing touches to her section of the tree. When she rejoined the others, she was looking rather white and tight-lipped. She had said goodnight a shade abruptly and went to her room. Walter, a very, very good husband, quickly joined her. "Anything the matter, old girl?" he asked anxiously. "Yes," replied Pamela. "I'm frightened."
"Frightened? What do you mean?"
"You'll think it's all rot, but I'll tell you. When you'd all left the ballroom, I suddenly felt very uneasy. You know, the sort of feeling one gets on looking round and can't concentrate. However, I stuck at it. I was a little way up the stairs when I heard a sharp hiss from above me in the tree. I jumped back to the floor and looked up. Now, of course, you won't believe me, but the trunk of the tree was moving. It was like the coils of a snake writhing upward, and there was something at the top of the tree, horrid-looking, peering at me. I know you won't believe me." Walter didn't, but he also didn't know what to make of it.
I know what happened, he improvised slightly. You had been staring in at that trunk for nearly 2 hours, and you got dizzy, like staring at the sun on the sea, and that snow dazzle this afternoon helped it. You've heard of snow blindness, something like that. It still echoes from the retina or whatever.
You think it might have been that?
I'm sure of it.
And that horrible head?
Well, as George put it, rather brightly, I think that some of the figures on those lamps shouldn't get a U certificate. There's the wolf to which he referred and the witch.
Which witch? Laughed Pamela a little hysterically. I didn't notice one.
I did. I was working just near it, at least I suppose it's meant to be a witch. A figure in black, squinting round from behind the tree. As a matter of fact, fairies never seemed all fun and frolic to me. There's often something diabolical about them, or rather, casually cruel. Disney knows that.
Yes, there is, agreed Pamela.
So you think that's all there was to it?
I'm certain. One's eyes can play tricks on one.
Yes, said Pamela. I know what you mean. As if they saw what one knew wasn't there or was different. Though, who would one be, then?
Oh, don't ask me that sort of question, laughed Walter. Probably Master Gregory will be able to tell you in a year or two.
He's a nice little boy, really, protested Pamela. Gloria just spoils him, and it's natural.
I know he is. It's not his fault, but they will force him. Look at that snowman, and staying behind to do it. A foul-looking thing.
Perhaps his eyes played funny tricks with him, said Pamela.
What do you mean by that?
I don't know why I said it, said Pamela, frowning. Sort of an echo, I suppose. Let's go to bed. Walter kissed her gently but fervently as he loved her. He was a one-ladies' man and had felt a bit nervous about her for a moment or two.
Was the house a little cooler, wondered Mr. Braxton as he was undressing, or was it just that he was getting more used to it? He was now convinced that there was something wrong with the installation. He'd get an expert down. Meanwhile, they must stick it. He yawned, wondered how Curtis was, and switched off the light. Soon, all of the occupants were at rest, and the great house swinging silently against the stars. Should have been at rest, rather, for one and all recalled that night with reluctance and dread. Their dreams were harsh and unhallowed, yet oddly related, being concerned with dim, uncertain, and yet somehow urgent happenings in and around the house, as though something or things were stirring while they slept and communicated their motions to their dreaming consciousness. They woke tired with a sense of unaccountable malaise. Mrs. Curtis rang up during breakfast, and her voice revealed her distress. Timothy was delirious and much worse. The doctor was coming at 10:30. Mr. and Mrs. Braxton decided to go over there and sent for the car. Knowles was waiting just outside the house when they arrived.
He's very bad, he said quietly. I've sent for two nurses and Sir Arthur Galley. I want another opinion.
Has he had some trouble with a tree?
Trouble with a tree, said Mr. Braxton, his nerves giving a flick.
Yes, it's probably just a haphazard, irrational idea of delirium, but he was continually fussing about some tree.
How bad is he? Asked Mr. Braxton.
The doctor frowned. I wish I knew. I'm fairly out of my depth.
He's keeping up his strength fairly well, but he can't go on like this.
As bad as that, exclaimed Mr. Braxton.
I'm very much afraid so. I'm anxiously awaiting Sir Arthur's verdict.
By the way, that cowman is very ill indeed. I'm sending him to the hospital.
What happened to him? Asked Mr. Braxton absently, his mind still on Curtis.
Apparently a branch of your Christmas tree snapped back at him and struck him in the face. Blood poisoning set in almost at once.
Mr. Braxton felt that tremor again, but merely nodded.
I was wondering if there might be some connection between the two, that Curtis is blaming himself for the accident.
Seems an absurd idea, but judging from his ravings, he appears to think that he is lashed to some tree and that the great heat he feels comes from it.
They went into the house and did their best to try to comfort and reassure Mrs. Curtis. Instructed Knowles to ring up as soon as Sir Arthur's verdict was known, and then drove home. The children had just come in from playing in the snow.
"Grandpa, the snowman's melted," said Patty.
"Did it thaw in the night?"
"Must have done," said Mr. Braxton, forcing a smile.
"Come and look, Grandpa," persisted Patty. "There's nothing left of it."
"Grandpa doesn't want to be bothered," said Mary, noticing his troubled face.
"I'll come," said Mr. Braxton.
When he reached the site of the snowman, his thoughts were still elsewhere, but his mind quickly refocused itself, for he was faced with something a little strange.
Not a vestige of the statue remained, though the snow was frozen crisp and crunched hard beneath his feet, and yet the snowman was completely obliterated, and where it had stood was a circle of bare brown grass.
"It must have thawed in the night and then frozen again," he said uncertainly.
"Then why?" began Patty.
"Don't bother Grandpa," said Mary sharply. "He's told you what happened."
They wandered off toward the heavy, hurrying river.
"Are those dog paw marks?" asked Phyllis.
That reminded Mr. Braxton. He peered down.
"Yes," he replied, "and I bet they're those of that brute of an Alsatian. It must be a colossal beast."
"And it must have paws like a young bear," laughed Mary.
"They're funny dogs, sort of Jekyll and Hydes. I rather adore them."
"You wouldn't adore this devil. He's all Hyde." "I'm in the wrong mood for these festivities," he thought irritably.
During the afternoon, George and Walter took the kids to the cinema in Oxford. The others finished the decorations of the tree. The presents, labeled with the names of their recipients, were arranged on tables round the room, and the huge cracker, 10 feet long and 40 inches in circumference, was placed on its gaily decorated trestle near the tree. Just as the job was finished, Mary did a three-quarters faint, but was quickly revived with brandy.
"It's the simply ghastly heat in the house," exclaimed Gloria, who was not looking too grand herself.
"The installation must be completely diseased. Ours always works perfectly."
Mary had her dinner in bed, and Jack came up to her immediately after he had finished his.
"How are you feeling, darling?" he asked.
"Oh, I'm all right."
"It was just the heat, of course."
"Oh, yes," replied Mary with rather forced emphasis.
"Scared you a bit going off like that?" suggested Jack, regarding her rather sharply.
"I'm quite all right, thank you," said Mary in a tone she always adopted when she had enough of a subject. "I'd like to rest. Switch off the lights."
But when Jack had gone, she didn't close her eyes, but lay on her back staring up at the faint outline of the ceiling. She frowned and lightly chewed the little finger of her left hand, a habit of hers when unpleasantly puzzled. Mary, like most people of strong character and limited imagination, hated to be puzzled. Everything she considered ought to have a simple explanation if one tried hard enough to find it. But how could one explain this odd thing that had happened to her? Besides the grandiose gifts on the table, which bore a number as well as the recipient's name, a small present for everyone was hung on the tree. This also bore a number, the same one as the lordly gift, so easing the Braxton task of handing these out to the right people. Mary had just fixed Curtis's label to a cigarette lighter and tied it on the tree when it swung on its silk thread so that the back of the card was visible, and on it was the description, "Died December 25th, 1938. It spun away and back again, and the inscription was no longer there. Now, Mary came of a family which rather prided itself on being unimaginative. Her father had confined his flights of fancy to the annual meeting of his shareholders, while to her mother, imagination and mendacity were at least first cousins. So Mary could hardly credit the explanation that, being remotely worried about Mr. Curtis, she had subconsciously concocted that sinister sentence. On the other hand, she knew poor Mr. Curtis was very ill, and therefore, perhaps, if her brain had played that malign little trick on her, it might have done so in tombstone writing. This was a considerable logical exercise for Mary. The effort tired her, the impression began to fade, and she started wondering how much longer Jack was going to sit up. She dozed off, and there, as if flashed on the screen inside her head, was "Died, December 25th, 1938. This, oddly enough, completely reassured her. There was nothing there this time. There had been nothing there the other time. She'd been very weak and imaginative even to think otherwise. While she was deciding this, Dr. Knowles rang up. "Sir Arthur has just been," he said, "and I'm sorry to say he's pessimistic. He says Curtis is very weak."
"But what's the matter with him?" asked Mr. Braxton urgently.
"He doesn't know. He calls it P-U-O, which really means nothing."
"But what does it stand for?"
"Pyrexia, unknown origin. There are some fevers which cannot be described more precisely."
"How ill is he, really?"
"All I can say is, we must hope for the best."
"My God!" exclaimed Mr. Braxton. "When's Sir Arthur coming again?"
"At 11 tomorrow. I'll ring you up after he's been."
Mr. Braxton excused himself and went to his room.
Like many men of his dominating, sometimes ruthless type, he was capable of an intensity of feeling, anger, resolution, desire for revenge, but also affection and sympathy, unknown to more superficially Christian and kindly souls. He was genuinely attached to Curtis and his wife, and very harshly and poignantly moved by this news, which, he realized, could hardly have been worse. He would have to exercise all his willpower if he was to sleep. If on the preceding night the rest of the sleepers had been broken by influences which had insinuated themselves into their dreams, that which caused the night of that Christmas Eve to be unforgettable was the demoniacal violence of the elements. The Northeaster had been waxing steadily all evening, and by midnight reached hurricane force, driving before it an almost impenetrable wall of snow. Not only so, but continually, all through the night, the wall was inflamed, and the roar of the hurricane silenced by fearful flashes of lightning and rafales of thunder. The combination was almost intolerably menacing. As the great house shook from the gale and trembled at the blasts, and the windows blazed with strange pyrochromatic balls of flame, all were tensed and troubled. The children fought or succumbed to their terror according to their natures. Their parents soothed and reassured them. Mr. Braxton was convinced the lightning conductors were struck 3 times within 10 minutes, and he could imagine them recoiling from the mighty impacts and seething from the terrific charges. Not till a dilatory, chaotic dawn staggered up the sky did the storm temporarily lull. For a time, the sky cleared and the frost came hard. It was a yawning and haggard company which assembled for breakfast, but determined efforts were made to engender a communal cheerfulness. Mr. Braxton did his best to contribute his quota of seasonal bonhomie, but his mind was plagued by thoughts of Curtis. Before the meal was finished, the vicar rang up to say that the church tower had been struck and almost demolished, so there would be no services. It rang again to say that Brent's farmhouse had been burnt to the ground. While others went off to inspect the church, Mr. Braxton remained in the study. Presently, Knowles rang to say that Sir Arthur had been and pronounced Curtis weaker, but his condition was not quite hopeless. One of the most ominous symptoms had been the violence of the delirium. Curtis appeared to be in great terror, and sedatives had no effect. "How's the cowman?" asked Mr. Braxton. "He died in the night, I'm sorry to say." Whereupon Mr. Braxton broke off one of his strictest rules by drinking a very stiff whiskey with very little soda. Christmas dinner was tolerably hilarious, and after it, the children, bulging and incipiently bilious, slept off some of it while the elders put the final touches to the preparations for the party. In spite of the weather, not a single cry-off was telephoned. There was good reason for this. Mr. Braxton's entertainments were justly famous. So, from 4:30 onwards, the cream of North Berkshire society came plowing through the snow to the hall, Lady Pouncer and her party bringing up the rear in their heirloom rolls, which was dribbling steam from its ancient and aristocratic beak. A tea of teas, not merely a high tea, an Everest tea, towering, skyscraping, was then attacked by the already stuffed juveniles who, by the end of it, were almost livid with repletion, finding even the efforts of cracker-pulling almost beyond them. They were then propelled into the library, where rows of chairs had been provided for them. There was a screen at one end of the room, a projector at the other. Mr. Braxton had provided one of his famous surprises. The room was darkened, and on the screen was flashed the sentence, "The North Berks Newsreel." During the last few weeks, Mr. Braxton had had a sharp-witted and discreetly furtive cameraman at work shooting some of the guests while busy about their more or less lawful occasions. For example, there was a sentence from a speech by Lord Gallen, the socialist peer: "It is a damnable and calculated lie for our opponents to suggest that we aim at a preposterous and essentially inequitable equalization of income." And then there was his lordship just entering his limousine, and an obsequious footman, rug in hand, holding the door open for him. His lordship's laughter was raucous and vehement, though he would have liked to have said a few words in rebuttal. And there was Lady Pouncer's rolls, locally known as the Hippogriff, stuck in a snowdrift and enveloped in steam, with the caption, "Oh, Mr. Mercury, do give me a start," and other kindly, slightly sardonic japes at the expenses of the North Berks cream. The last scene was meant as an appropriate prelude to the climax of the festivities. It showed Curtis and his crew digging up the tree from Lucky's Grove.
Out they came from the holm oaks, straining under their load, but close observers noticed that there was one who remained behind, standing menacing and motionless. A very tall, dark, brooding figure. There came a blinding lightning flash, which seemed to blaze sparking round the room, and a fearsome metallic bang. The storm had returned, with rasping and imperious salute. The lights immediately came on, and the children were marshaled into the ballroom. As they entered and saw the high tree shining there and the little people so lively upon its branches, a prolonged ooh of astonishment was extorted from the blasé brats. But there was another blaze of flame against the windows, which rattled wildly at the ensuing roar, and the cries of delight were tinged with terror. And indeed, the hard blue glare flung a sinister glow on the tree and its whirling throng. The grown-ups hastened to restore equanimity, and forming rings for children circled round the tree. Presently, Mrs. Braxton exclaimed, "Now then, look for your names on the cards and see what Father Christmas has brought you." Though hardly one of the disillusioned infants retained any belief in that superannuated deliverer of goods, the response was immediate. For they had sharp ears, which had eagerly absorbed the tales of Braxton munificence. At the same time, it was noticeable that some approached the tree with diffidence, almost reluctance, and started back as a livid flare broke against the window blinds and the dread peals shook the streaming snow from the eaves. Mary had just picked up little Angela Rayner so she could reach her card when the child screamed out and pulled away her hand. "The worm!" she cried, and a thick, gray, squirming maggot fell from her fingers to the floor and writhed away. George, who was near, put his shoe on it with a squish. One of the Pouncer tribe, whose card was just below the big bad wolf, refused to approach it. No wonder, thought Walter, for it looked horribly hunting and alive. There were other mischances, too. The witch behind the somber tree seemed to pounce out at Clarissa Balder, so she tearfully complained, and Gloria had to pull off her card for her. Of course, Gregory was temperamental, seeming to stare at a spot just below the taut peak of the tree, as if amazed and entranced. But the presents were wonderful and more than worth the small ordeal of finding one's card and pretending not to be frightened when the whole room seemed full of fiery hands and the thunder cracked against one's eardrums and shook one's teeth. Easy to be afraid. At length the last present had been bestowed, and it was time for the piece de resistance, the pulling of the great cracker. Long silken cords streamed from each end, with room among them for 50 chubby fists and a great surprise inside for sure. The languid, uneasy troop were lined up at each end and took grip of the silken cords. At that moment a footman came in and told Mr. Braxton he was wanted on the telephone. Filled with foreboding, he went to his study. He heard the voice of Knowles. "I'm afraid I have very bad news for you." The chubby fists gripped the silken cords. "Now pull," cried Mrs. Braxton. The opposing teams took the strain. A leaping flash and a blasting roar. The children were hurled, writhing and screaming over each other. Up from the middle of the cracker leapt a rosy shaft of flame which, as it reached the ceiling, seemed to flatten its peak so that it resembled a great snake of fire which turned and hurled itself against the tree in a blinding embrace. There was a fierce, sustained hiss, the tree flamed like a torch, and all the fairy globes upon it burst and splintered. And then the roaring torch cast itself down amongst the screaming chaos. For a moment, the great pot, swathed in green, was a carmine cauldron, and its paint streamed like blood upon the floor. Then the big room was a dream of fire, and those within it driven wildly from its heat. Phil Tangler, whose farmhouse on the early slopes of the Missen Rise overlooked both Lucky's Grove and the hall, solemnly declared that at 7:30 on Christmas Day, 1938, he was watching from a window and marveling at the dense and boiling race of snow, the bitter gale, and the wicked flame and fury of the storm, when he saw a huge fist of fire form in a rift in the cloud rack. A fist with two huge blazing fingers, one of which speared down on the hall, another touched and kindled the towering fir in Lucky's Grove, as though saluting it. 5 minutes later, he was racing through the hurricane to join, in vain, a night-long fight to save the hall, already blazing from stem to stern. Hey, thanks so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed that.
And once again, I hope that you had a wonderful Thanksgiving and that your Christmas season is off to a fantastic start. I'm looking forward to spending the rest of it with you. Christmas Past is produced in wonderful Willow Glen, California by yours truly, Brian Earle. I'd like to thank my friends at Biblioasis Publishing for once again inviting me to share these stories with you. Check the show notes for a link to more information. You can drop me a line anytime, and so many of you already have. I love hearing from you, and I try to respond to every message I get. You can always reach me at christmaspastpodcast@gmail.com or connect with me on your favorite social media platform. If you don't see me there and think I ought to be, reach out and let me know. As this Christmas season is just warming up, maybe you're already reminiscing about Christmases from your past. How about sharing one of those Christmas memories with the rest of the Christmas Past family? All you have to do is record yourself speaking into your phone's voice memo app and send it to christmaspastpodcast@gmail.com. Keep it reasonably short, clean, and family-friendly, and be sure to say your name and where you're from. And if you're really feeling the Christmas spirit, why not help more people discover this show to help grow the Christmas Past family? That's as simple as telling a friend about it or leaving a rating and review. If you do leave a review, I'll send you a Christmas Past sticker, and a handwritten Christmas card is my way of saying thanks any time of year. Get in touch for details. And until we meet again, may your days be merry and bright.